It's The Wonky Show. Policy Exchange says universities are flogging visas, not degrees. Could a flat rate levy and tougher language tests sort the problem? New student leaders are taking office. How should universities respond? And meta science goes mainstream. What on earth does that mean? It's all coming up.
Some of it's got to do with underfunding and just the challenges that young people face today in general around living costs, but also, you know, the rise of anxiety and mental health challenges. So...
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us understand what on earth is going on, as usual, three top-line guests. In Manchester, on the world-famous Oxford Road, Duncan Iverson is President and Vice-Chancellor at the University of Manchester. Duncan, your highlight of the week, please.
We're having our staff awards today, which is a pretty special event at the university. Looking forward to that.
Cracking stuff. Love those events. In the Cotswolds, Vicky Stott is Chief Exec at the QAA. Vicky, your highlight of the week, please.
Hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen on Saturday when I'm going with my partner's daughter to the Bristol Tattoo Convention, something I've always wanted to do.
Well, there you go. Details of that in the show notes. And in Monmouth this week, Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I've got a good one this week, actually, for once. On Monday, I went to my hometown, Belfast, where I did my undergrad, in fact, and saw Alanis Morissette in concert in Ormo Park. And it was, although it wasn't my wedding day, ironically, it was raining.
Hey! Yes, right now. So we start this week with immigration. Everyone's favourite Tufton Street think tank, Policy Exchange, has published a thing on international students. Debbie, what does it say?
Well, yes, the headline of this report is, its title is Education, Not Immigration. And the central kind of conceit of it is that expressing a concern that study in the UK is becoming a route to work and settlement rather than simply for the pursuit of education and then they're going home and then the applying of those skills in other contexts. Now, obviously, different people will have different views about A, whether that is actually true, and B, whether even if it were true, how big a deal that is. But for the author of this report and for Policy Exchange more generally, and the kind of the sorts of people that kind of hang around in that milieu, it is a very big deal. So I think what's interesting about this report is there's a real focus here on trying to differentiate in a way that the sector is often quite resistant to between what the report describes as highly ranked research intensive institutions. And the argument goes that actually there's really quite a significant cross subsidy from the scale and the prices charged for international students into those institutions. And also that cross subsidy is funding things that we as a country care about, which is world leading research. The argument then runs, well, actually in the what it's describing as lower ranked institutions, the cross subsidy is lower, and the stuff it's funding is, you know, it's sort of tacitly kind of implied as less important. The key recommendations are to restrict the graduate route to research degree holders only, to increase the standards for English language required of international students, and critically, don't allow higher education institutions to administer that test and award their own kind of certifications. It proposes that there should be a £1,000 levy on international students, but paid by the students themselves rather than by institutions. So if you think back to the immigration white paper, the proposal was that there could be a 6% levy on international student income payable by institutions. And obviously that's going to have to be kind of worked up quite a lot more before that turns into a real policy, but that's what the proposal was. And finally, not to let EU students have access to the student loan book or be charged domestic fee rates.
Now, well, there's all sorts in here. You know, we could start kind of with the detail or start with the big picture. I guess big picture, Duncan, this what I often think is quite an artificial divide between broadly, you know, education and what you want to do with the rest of your life. Are we stuck there in this kind of in the way that Policy Exchange have kind of framed this, or is there a, you know, is there a different story to tell about, of course, young people all want to, you know, improve their lives, and that's partly about education, partly about their career, and maybe it's also partly about staying here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a forced divide. I mean, obviously, education is a lifelong good. It's not a sort of product that you buy and then use up. So, and also immigration is an important part of, you know, our economy, our society. It's the way that countries sort of get better and flourish. So there's a broader context, which I think the report probably doesn't quite capture. But having said that, the other issue is just it's a complex area as well. I mean, the way in which the international education market works is quite complex. Different students have different preferences, different needs, different ambitions, different dreams. And I think we need to recognize that. The report goes some way of doing that. But I do think we need to recognize the differences. There's no question that international education is a massive reason why the UK has such a terrific higher education sector for all its challenges. I mean, that's just unquestionable. So we need to get real about that. We don't want to see shonky practice. We don't want to see education used as a sort of workaround to migration. But we've got to recognize the incredible contribution that international education makes to the not just the UK higher education system, but to our economies, both national and local, to our cultural creative sectors, to a whole range of areas. And I think that's often missing, I think, in the current debate. It gets a bit too narrow too quickly.
But let me ask you this question, Duncan, actually. So, you know, if I think about the way international students and this debate has kind of played out over, say, a decade, what universities have tended to do is say, I mean, they haven't quite said this, but, you know, effectively being an international student is a kind of educational holiday. Don't count them in the net migration figures. They all go home. This is all about soft power. And at the same time, our birth rate's falling, our population's getting older, we need more people in the kind of working age population to support public services. We need immigration. Now, if universities kind of rely on something that isn't really true anymore, haven't we got a problem? Isn't it for universities to kind of, to some extent, lead that debate on, you know, the future of the country?
Yeah, I mean, certainly my view is we want really talented, successful migrants to come to the UK, whether it's for university or through other ways to help, you know, create the kind of prosperity that we all benefit from. I mean, having said that, it's also really important for the country and for governments, whatever your politics, to demonstrate that they've got control, especially of legal migration, right? I mean, that is just a political fact that we have to grapple with. So I think when universities talk about, you know, the way that international students, for example, in Manchester, we have one of the highest retention rates of graduates. Once they've graduated from us, a lot of our students stay in Manchester, and many of them are international students. Many of them go on and do incredible things. But also international students have their own, you know, ambitions and preferences. Some of them want to come, get a degree, work for 2 years, well, now it'll be 18 months, and then go back to, you know, their home country or go off and do another degree somewhere else or do a job somewhere else. So I think we have to be really upfront about the contribution that international students and migration in general makes to our society, not just to the economy, but to the society more generally. But at the same time, recognize politically, you know, governments will need to sort of demonstrate that their legal pathways of migration are kind of robust and reliable, and our communities are comfortable that we're managing that in the appropriate way. So I think that's what universities are often trying to balance.
Yes, but that desire, particularly for Keir Starmer, a relative technocrat, to kind of be seen to get a grip is, you know, in terms of positioning, really important. Now, on this grip thing, Vicky, the report, I think it's really important. You know, the report basically says the problem here is that universities are marking English language homework, right? Broadly, he's saying, look, you've got to externalize testing to raise standards. Now, you know, should universities accept that, you know, there has been some bad practice, and or is it the case that universities should say there isn't really a problem here, you know, produce your evidence?
I mean, you know, I think the answer is that there is a worry that there is bad practice always, but without having some kind of peer review around what's happening, you can't be sure. If we're not looking at it, you cannot be sure. So I guess the simple answer is, if you want to be sure there's no bad practice, then externalize the testing. But you know, universities have complete autonomy over their recruitment practices, and you wouldn't want to see institutional autonomy being eroded. I think there are bigger problems around the quality argument, though, and that is this kind of reliance in this report and several before it on the idea of league table rankings and prestige being the metric by which we should say who can and who can't have how many students. And, you know, as you know, Jim, I'm preaching to the choir here. Prestige rankings in league tables are not the same as quality. League tables do many things, but they do not measure the quality of provision. And so saying that because you're number 4 or 5 or 6 in a league table, or because you're in the top 500, you can have more of this thing than other people, seems to me to be misplaced faith in what a league table can tell us about a provider.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it, Debbie? Because, you know, I mean, OFS will talk about kind of risk-based approach. And I guess what it really means when it says a risk-based approach is, you know, I mean, the simple version of this is kind of in this report, which is, as Vicky describes, you know, the high prestige institutions can sort of, you know, keep their freedoms, and others you get red tape. But it must be the case, mustn't it, that if particularly if you think about the wider tertiary sector, you just need different regulatory approaches for different parts of the sector. So if it's not this, what is it?
I certainly think when OFS has thought about risk, one of the things it has thought about is about track record. And I think that there's a case for saying, look, if you've sort of demonstrated yourself in the past to be trustworthy, there's no real reason to think that all of a sudden you would become untrustworthy. So there's a degree to which you kind of, it's an earned trust economy, isn't it? I think also there is something here that I think this is something where the sector has real challenges to navigate, because it's about the kind of rapid increase. And that's what we saw a couple of years ago in that sort of post-COVID space. That's, I think, what is driving a lot of the kind of angst and public kind of nervousness and policy chatter, which actually the overall numbers have sort of come back down again and are now kind of, you know, possibly rising at a much gentler level. And so there's something there about triggers for investigation as well. So I think that, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, this is the system kind of being designed in a way that it's that you're essentially able to earn trust, and then if something kind of looks funny, then questions start getting asked. But I mean, to be honest, Jim, I think, you know, I don't think that's a million miles from the system we actually have.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear UKVI don't poke around in every institution, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, where there's something kind of that appears to be a little bit off, you know, UKVI will come and ask some questions. And I mean, and there's definitely an argument about whether that's too intrusive and whether it's sufficiently transparent and whether it's kind of grounded in you know, fair reasoning that is visible to the providers and all the rest of it. But I mean, that's essentially the kind of the world we're working in. And whether you think that is sufficient comes down to whether I think what it can't come down to is, are we just bringing in too many of them? that's just not, you know, this is all about, you know, thinking about, and I think some of the immigration white paper proposals are quite smart in this area. So we're saying, well, actually, can you evidence that if you're recruiting lots of international students, that there's a support for integration, that you've considered the impact on the local community, that you're doing this in a kind of considered and sustainable way? You know, that's how you build trust, right?
Yeah. So a kind of value added in your proposal. I guess, you know, Duncan, the other option is, you know, if we were being policy wonky about this, we would say, okay, don't design a policy that's all about reputation and playing to the backbench gallery. Design a policy that's about the extent to which you rely on the money, or the extent to which there's a cross subsidy. I mean, there's all sorts of options, aren't there?
There are, yeah. And I do think that trust and verify sort of model is sort of the one we have, or I'm learning to think it is. And I think that's probably the right way to go. I mean, one thing about the report that was interesting to me is, I mean, especially around language sort of assessment, it's just not true that every university does its own assessment. I mean, we don't rule. There's a lot of, and you know, our English language standards are, you know, above all the minimum standards, even some of them proposed in the report. So there's a lot of variation in the sector that we have to, you know, get clear about. So I think the report's less helpful on that particular matter than I think it probably should be. You know, I think there is probably, there is shonky practice going on, I think, in the sector, and we should be honest about that. It should be called out and it should be stopped. And I think that's where the OFS and other regulatory bodies have a role to play. And I think the sector shouldn't be shy about that. I mean, sometimes we might sort of hide behind our sector bodies and not want to really admit that, but I think we've got to be honest about it. But at the end of the day, you know, international education, as I said earlier, plays a huge role in the success of higher education in the UK, as it does more generally in the country. And we shouldn't shy away from that. We should understand it, you know, make sure we're explaining it. I think people deserve explanations about, you know, what contributions are being made by our national students and by institutions who are investing in research in the way that they do. And, you know, that's on the sector, but it's also, I think, on our regulator and on the government of the day to really make that clear to people.
Here's a question for you though, Duncan, right? So back in 2019, I think it was, when, you know, just before the pandemic and Boris gets re-elected and we're a buccaneering trading nation all around the world and the graduate route gets reintroduced and famously, I've written about this about 30 times on the site, famously the Home Office's risk assessment, the impact assessment, was pretty much place blind, right? You know, inflows, outflows, looks at the whole country and so on, and actually never clocked and never thought about what happens if there's a clustering effect or there's tons of international students in one city and hardly any in others, housing, blah, 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 blah. If the graduate route kind of tightens again and it gets much more kind of hostile and that impacts, you know, you and Manmet and so on. What kind of happens to sort of regional skills pipelines, the kind of stuff we talk about in other items on the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real risk. And right now, if we go to 18 months, don't forget, that'll be less than what's currently on offer in Canada and Australia, and to a different extent in the US, you know, among the other things that are happening in those countries. So that's automatically going to differentiate us. And we know that, I don't know, roughly a third of international students think about that when they're making their decisions about where they're going to study. So it's not trivial. I mean, I understand why the government's done it. But yeah, I mean, certainly in the Greater Manchester region, one of the biggest challenges we've got is building the skills base for what is now a growing economy, and an economy that's getting more complex in a good way. More highly skilled jobs are being generated, more innovation, more, you know, development is going on in our region, in our city in particular. And, you know, skills is probably the number one thing that people talk to me about in the business community and in the local sort of council conversations. So there is a genuine risk that if this government is all about growth, 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 then some of the things they're doing in the white paper, well, a number of things they're doing in the white paper are completely under, they're going to undermine that.
Vicky, the kind of wider question I think about the language thing is, if I think about quality, and I'm talking to people about, you know, kind of program quality or institutional quality and so on, people are often talking about provision. And what they're really rarely talking about is, you know, that bit where you're supposed to, if you have control of admissions, determine whether or not someone can really succeed on the program. Is that, do you think that's a problem? Because in one way, I think you could read this as, you know, DfE is nowhere to be seen. And there's a huge allegation here that universities are no longer properly assessing whether someone can benefit from or succeed on a program. And it's an allegation that feels at this point no one is kind of fighting.
I think it's a really interesting question, Jim. But what worries me about all of these ideas in a way is how little evidence there is to support them. So, you know, it may well be that people aren't properly assessing whether international students have the capacity or the support that they need to succeed beyond their language skills. But where's the evidence for that? You know, it may well be that students staying on the graduate visa and taking jobs is a problem for local employment, but there's no evidence for that. It could be that, you know, students staying on the international route, as you say, cluster and support and cause problems in housing locally, or conversely, that they support delivery of the local skills agenda. But there's no evidence. I think these are all ideas that it's worth having conversations about when you're trying to design a policy, but without any kind of evidence, all you're doing is, you know, pushing buttons at random and hoping that you end up with a typed and well-argued thesis.
But I mean, in many ways, Debbie, I think, you know, we're in a kind of vibes era, aren't we? So actually, I'm just going to pop in a clip here from Britain's most listened to political podcast, where Rory Stewart, of all people, was talking about what he thinks about international students.
There was, I think, quite a smart policy which was put in place by Rishi Sunak to say the very top students in the world should be fast-tracked. So it's very easy to get a visa to come to the United Kingdom, or was under him if you'd been to Harvard, whatever. That isn't quite the same as what I see, unfortunately, when I go often to graduation ceremonies for some British universities that are not on the top tier. Often they are actually universities that have been really struggling in terms of student numbers, financial viability, and are bringing in a very, very large number of not particularly top-notch students.
From China?
No. I mean, an enormous number of the last graduation I went to had actually come from Nigeria. And as far as I could tell, they actually only did a few weeks of study in the United Kingdom. They were an incredibly important revenue stream. They got to go back and say that they had a degree from this university. I was not certain that they were top flight students. I was not certain they were making a huge contribution to the British economy. And I was a bit worried that actually what we've got here is a system where we're not funding our universities properly. So we're forcing
to
bring in people who may not actually be making a huge contribution.
I've said a few weeks ago, and we said yesterday on the main episode, that, you know, we thought there wasn't this sort of national story. Part of the national story for Britain, I think, is that this is a place to welcome the brightest, the best brains around the world. And at a time, for example, when Donald Trump is whacking the intellectual elite and the arts and humanities and top universities and undermining their reputation, we should be trying to get those people to come here.
Well, I think
I think if I'm sort of answering with my head and my heart here, which is that I think the relationship between vibes and evidence has to be tightened up, shall we say. So, I mean, but here's a good example, right, from the report. And I mean, I don't know whether Rory Stewart's students that he's talking about were postgrad or undergrad, but statistically, the likelihood is that they were postgrads, right? And one of the things that the report is saying is you know, it appears that it says that domestic student numbers have been are reducing in real terms, which I'm not quite sure of. I'm not sure that there's a sort of inflationary impact on student numbers, but there's the kind of argument that in some institutions there, you know, proportionally there's been a reduction in domestic students. But what it doesn't do is differentiate between undergrad and postgrad, right? And I think, you know, one of the things that is often not really discussed because of the vibes, you know, vibe, is that what we're talking about is level 7 students. They're coming in, they're doing a year of master's level study, a postgraduate qualification, and that is a very specific, coming back to Duncan's point about, you know, the skills impacts, that those are often extremely high value courses. They're courses that would not necessarily exist without that international student input, because the market and the economy at the postgraduate level, level 7, the domestic economy is very different from the undergraduate economy. And so there is, I think, a need to really develop some evidence around level 7 and to try and understand that economy and what it's doing in the skills landscape, particularly in the relationship between skills and innovation, and then think about where international students can support that. And then ideally kind of then sort of saying, well, look, actually the sorts of judgments that you might bring to bear in this vibes based way about, you know, what's going on with students, you're thinking about it in terms of this kind of world of undergraduate provision, which is different. Actually, it's just a different thing from what's actually going on here.
Actually, Duncan, I think that creates one more question, right? Which is, you know, one of the things we often talk about in the franchising debate is, you know, you can talk about widening access, you can talk about the cross subsidy and so on. But actually, one of the things that sticks out like a sore thumb is the sheer volume of students that are on pretty cheap to teach, you know, boilerplate business studies courses. Now, the big increase in international PGT, bits of it are about, you know, innovation and skills and people going on to do PGR and so on and so on. Actually, a huge volume of it is people doing business studies. Now, if in the end, one of the reasons that all of this is happening is that the government's trying to keep numbers under control, is one of the options to control by subject?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, right? Because who can predict which subjects matter most and when and for what reason? And also you have, you know, we're in a sort of market. So, you know, students are actually making choices and and institutions are responding to those choices in part. So I think that would be a really hard policy framework to get right, because, you know, it would change quickly. I mean, I do think we need to build confidence in government and in the general community that universities are managing and recruiting in the right way. And as I said earlier, you know, if there are shonky practices going on, they need to be stopped. They need to be called out. And, you know, if that means the sector has to sort of say to some of its colleagues, hey, that's just not right, that's just not on, I think we need to be really open and honest about that. I mean, the other thing, just on the point about evidence, which I think is a really good one, I mean, we have lots of evidence, actually, about what people think about international students, what people think about the contribution that universities are making to local communities. And it always surprised, I mean, maybe it shouldn't surprise me, but people just don't sort of pay attention to it. I mean, we poll people in Manchester, for example, about what they think about international students. We poll people about what they think about our graduates. There's lots of, you know, the Russell Group during the graduate visa debate, I wasn't here then, but I've seen it, you know, did some really nice work as well. So we kind of know what the community thinks in general about these things. And we know that when they get nervous, it's when they feel as though there's no sort of rationale or there's no clear framework around what we're doing when it comes to student intake and student recruitment. And we just need to be really open and transparent about that. And, you know, that's both on the sector, I think, and on the government.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Denise Baker from the University of Derby. This week on Wonky, I've blogged about the prospects for apprenticeships in health and social care ahead of the publication of the NHS's 10-year plan. You'll be aware that the funding for Level 7 apprenticeships has shifted to lower levels. The introduction of new foundation apprenticeships adds to a rather crowded number of pathways at Level 2. Meanwhile, the removal of Level 7 apprenticeship funding threatens careers and skills development for practitioners, likely leading to role stagnation. Research published by the University of Derby and University Alliance identified what's working well and what needs to be improved in delivering degree apprenticeships. Ultimately, I'm arguing that those in higher education and the NHS must continue to make the case to policymakers for healthcare apprenticeships at all levels. So please read the blog, add your comments, and join in the debate.
Now, next up, student leaders. This week is the one where the cosmic ballet goes on, and we've been trawling their manifestos, the new ones that have all taken office this week, to see what they said to get elected. Duncan, what are they saying?
Yeah, this is fascinating. So I'm a former student hack, so I found this incredibly fun to read, but also coming to Manchester and having a really great student union to work with and a great student culture around student unionism. It's been a fascinating thing to sort of reflect on. I mean, what's really interesting is just this really, I think, profound shift going on whereby academic life is now no longer really the primary sort of orbit within which students move, right? They're balancing work and study. They're trying to find a way to create, you know, get support for paying for increasing living costs and the costs of higher education. A lot of the SU sort of manifestos and candidates are talking about better services from universities, more financial support, more help with employability, better student experience in general. There's, you know, fascinating, and this is true here at Manchester as well, a lot of students want us to do a better job of helping them learn. And, you know, there's an interesting challenge there for our institutions to think, hang on, are we actually focused enough on the student experience than perhaps we have been in the past? There's a lot of, I think, demand as well for greater, not surprisingly, maybe greater transparency and decision-making. I think the role of student voice has probably never been more important. But I think the big message for me is just this kind of shift now in that for a lot of our students, university is just one of the many things they do over the course of the day. And for some of my colleagues, that is very confronting, right? I mean, you know, they think, hey, you're in my classroom, you're doing my course, you know, you're focused on Aristotle this semester, not on your part-time job down at the Academy 2 or whatever. So I think that's a really deep shift that's occurring. You know, some of it's got to do with underfunding and just the challenges that young people face today in general around living costs, but also, you know, the rise of anxiety and mental health challenges. So I think this is a really big challenge for the sector, and we've really got to grapple with it. It's something actually I'm talking a lot about with our student leaders. So really, really interesting set of sort of themes that have come out of the most recent student union elections.
Funnily enough, Debbie, I was talking to a new student leader this week, who shall be named, who said that when they were an ambassador for the university, for an open day, someone in marketing had said, can you sort of sketch out, you know, what an average week is like for students? And she'd sketched it out, and then they very much deliberately did not use it, right? Because it kind of consisted on, well, maybe I'll try and read a PDF on my phone on the bus, and then, you know, I've got to go to my shift at work and blah, 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 blah. And broadly, what the marketing person wanted was, yes, and then I sit at my desk and I study for 4 hours and so on. But I mean, one of the things that really came through, I think, certainly for me and Mac reading them this year was, if Duncan's right, and I think he is, you know, there's a whole range of things that people would like, you know, support with and so on. Is it even possible for universities, even if they had the money, to influence all of these things? Have universities kind of backed themselves into this sunshine indoors, we'll do everything corner?
Yeah, well, there's something there, I think, about the sort of, I guess, sort of simplistic presentation of student life that is really worth everybody thinking a bit more about. But I think this is a trend that we've been sort of seeing as, you know, and essentially what we're talking about is the erosion of public services and living standards that have left universities being the kind of last body standing that can scoop up some of these sort of broader lived experience challenges, as well as, I think, you know, with the effect of COVID, you know, I suppose there's probably nicer ways to put this, but students just aren't as grown up as they used to be, right? You know, the ones that are coming straight from school. So there's a bit of, you know, we just need a bit more handholding. You know, that is an expectation. That doesn't necessarily mean that makes it university's responsibility, but it does, you know, to be kind of really pragmatic about it. There's a, you know, if you need students to be successful, you need to be able to continue to recruit students, and for the kind of response from students not to be, I was left hanging out to dry without all the kind of support that I needed. So I think there's two things here. One is about being really thoughtful about, you know, what's a priority, and really kind of thinking about what the framework for making that decision is, because, you know, obviously the resource isn't endless and continues to be much less of it. Jim, you've said kind of frequently and at length about the value of doing things differently, right? About sort of saying this is not, universities cannot do things for students. I gave a talk earlier in the week to an institution that is trying to really think about how it develops its co-curricular offer in a really systematic and you know, a way that builds the student agency. And the kind of point I made was, you know, back in the day, we did things to students and then we did things for students when, you know, fees went up. Now we're entering an era where it's about saying, well, how do we do things with students or enable students to do things on their own behalf? And that's the space that I think that universities are going to be getting into. And there's already loads of that really good stuff going on, but it's thinking about putting resource into the enablement of student activity that can then scale, perhaps rather than the delivery of stuff to students.
Vicky, one of the things that we sort of noticed, and actually I didn't put much of that in the blog this week, actually, but did talk about it in last year's, there's a kind of trend where, you know, almost by definition, it must be the case that on some programs in some institutions, quality is getting worse. You know, this is what happens when you reduce the unit of resource. But one of the things that neither me nor Mac can escape, given we sort of know the quality code or, you know, the kind of B conditions in England, like the back of our hand, is we'll look at a pledge from a student officer and think, well, that's a minimum standard. You know, that's not an improvement. That's a breach. You know, they should be submitting a group complaint, you know, blah, blah, blah. Are we at risk of kind of sleepwalking into falling below the kind of minimum standards? Because in those scenarios, given, you know, you can't do quality enhancement anymore, because quality enhancement depends on the assumption that everything is good and we're trying to make it even better.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a real risk that as resources become tighter and tighter, and on both sides of the kind of student provider table, resources are getting tighter and tighter, right? There is a real risk that that affects quality as offered and as experienced. And I think there's a problem with doing enhancement or doing things with students or kind of empowering students to have greater input and student voice in institutional decision making, when traditionally academic regulations and student life tend to meet in a fairly clashing and confronting way. And I don't think this is new, right? I was a student in 1989. I had my first child at university. I was studying, funnily enough, philosophy at Manchester. And the academic regulations then simply were not set up in a way that it was easy for somebody who'd recently given birth to do an exam. And that took some sorting out. I think, you know, the idea that students have conflicting calls on their time and find it increasingly difficult to participate in both their studies and in the organizational quality aspects of their institution, it's got bigger, but it's not a new problem. And I think the real problem is that we're kind of now used to the slogan that we do nothing about you without you. We take no decisions about you without you. But unless we're making our decision-making processes and our quality processes really accessible to our students, then what we're doing is offering them an opportunity to witness decision making rather than participate in quality systems, right? And we need to acknowledge that those are very different things. And in a resource poor environment, if you really enable students to participate, you are increasing your capacity, you're increasing your resource. So giving them that power to do more than simply witness helps both sides of the table to improve the quality.
The other question I was going to ask you, Duncan, was, so last year, I might have told this story on the podcast before, but so apologies to listeners if I have. But late last year, I ended up going to a presentation from the fellow that runs the Manchester United Federation, who was doing some widening access work in Northern Ireland. And he was saying, look, you know, if you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, then broadly, all the staff in that charity were hanging around in the kind of top level of Maslow, right? What we do here is self-actualize. You know, we get them onto campus, they look at the facilities and blah, blah, blah. But he was saying that they'd worked out that, you know, in the cost of living crisis, what they really had to do was start doing work further down in Maslow, right? They had to start focusing on belonging and whether those students were warm and whether they were still hungry and so on. And it seems to me that in the end, therefore, universities end up with two choices. If their key beneficiaries, you know, are not there on the top, you know, are not able to benefit from the top layer of Maslow, either universities kind of reach further down and do lots of work on belonging and cost of living and mental health and so on, or they say, this cannot be for us to do on the funding you give us. You know, this is for the rest of the state to step in. You know, what should universities do?
Look, it's a really great question and a live question in the sector. And I have to say, since Rowan, by the way, the fact that Vicky studied philosophy in Manchester, of course, explains all the incredible success she's had. It's a genius entirely. But look, that's a really, and I have to say, coming back to the UK after 30 years, I mean, it is, I find it extraordinary that the work that universities do in this country around student living costs and around student support. I mean, in Manchester, for example, the universities have teamed up to provide a acute mental health crisis provision that is, you know, second to none, sector leading. It's really impressive, but it is under enormous pressure now. And the thing I was going to mention is, don't forget, the OFS keeps sort of piling on expectations and standards onto the sector in some of these areas as well. So often our conditions are increasingly linked to our ability to do these things. So there's no question that it's under strain, because if we're expected to provide, as a, you know, as you, Jim, in your terms, to reach down now and into those other kinds of needs and challenges that our students face. And I think most of us see the importance of that, because our students are much more diverse. We're recruiting, and it's a good thing, students from much more varied backgrounds now, I hope. And that means students are coming to us with different needs, different backgrounds, different requirements. I don't think there's much option but for us to do it, but it's under enormous strain. And certainly, you know, there have been conversations with other, you know, vice chancellors and whatnot over the past year, where many of them said, look, we're just not going to be able to do this in the forthcoming years because of the fiscal situation their institutions are in. Or, and this is another option, and this is what we've done in Manchester, we're just going to have to find a way to do this together, right? We're just, the idea that one institution can provide all of these things is just unrealistic. And I'm a big believer in the sector having to self-organize, preferably before the government forces us to, in so many different dimensions. And this is an area where I think we just need to collaborate much more deeply and much more systematically.
Debbie, one final question on this. So again, I was talking to someone this week who, because I think, you know, I mean, Vicky makes a series of good points, right, about students as partners, and you know, you've certainly done some fascinating work on students as partners over the years. A student leader who was broadly saying, look, they're very much being kept at arm's length over a institutional change process. You know, broadly, they're not in the room. They're not really allowed to ask questions. As and when the university has worked out who it's making voluntarily redundant, there will be a conversation with the students' union about communicating it. Now, there are real tensions, aren't there, and real kind of potential legal risks, I guess, with involving student leaders in some of these really crunchy change processes that are coming. So should universities take the risk or not?
I think that if, I mean, and you know, this isn't you, Jim, I think this happens in universities too, that what you've just done is, this is a sort of paradigmatic, you know, category slippage between change process and redundancy process there, that, you know, and I would absolutely say, absolutely, you know, you should be building your change agendas with students from the get-go, right? Because you need to think about how do you change the operating model. One of the consequences of that is that there may be some staff restructures and redundancies. And I think at the sort of very high level, it's probably working through with students what those impacts, the student unions want, what those impacts might be. But in terms of like those detailed discussions about where we're cutting and you know how we're going to run that process, I'm not sure that that's something that's it is worth or necessary to have students involved in. Like, there may be an argument on the other hand, but you know, I think where the kind of, and this I think is the challenge for universities, is saying the approach cannot just be where can we strip out costs. It is about transformation. It's about doing things differently. And that's the bit of the conversation that students really, really need to be involved in, not only because they can be partners, but also because they, you know, they will have really useful insight to contribute. when it's about, you know, people's lives and people losing their jobs and having their jobs changed in different ways, that feels like a level of expertise and responsibility that may not be particularly useful for students to be in. There may be contexts in which, you know, that judgment could be made differently, but that would be my kind of approach to it, I think, on the face of it.
Now, finally, meta science. The government has a new meta science unit. Vicky, what is meta science?
Jim, you know, when I saw that you'd given me this segment to introduce, my first thought was, why do you hate me? I went and read the report, and it really is. It's a fascinating interrogation of the systems that shape our thinking, sometimes quite literally. The report is a landmark moment. It's part audit, part manifesto. It asks whether our research ecosystem is optimized for truth or simply for publishability. Are we really funding the very best ideas, or are we just funding the best grant writers? And are peer reviews a quality filter, or are they a bottleneck? These are certainly questions that resonate with my research active peers. And Wonky have called it meta science's coming of age. If this is adulthood, what kind of grown-up is UK science becoming? Is it a responsible steward of public knowledge? Or is it something that reads much more like a slightly chaotic academic flatshare with too many metrics and not enough replication? I think the report was surprisingly written in wonderfully accessible language, and it gives us some super interesting data about the discipline of meta science, or the disciplines of meta science, and why it shouldn't be forced into becoming a discipline in its own right. I was particularly struck by the characterization of the social contract between science and society being fundamentally fractured by controversies around things like bovine spongiform encephalitis, which seems a long time ago now, genomic alteration of crops, and ethical questions around who funds science. And it seems as though the meta science unit is really creating serious conversations about how do we do science better? How do we become less bureaucratic, more affordable, and critically much more reproducible?
Do you know what? I have read the report. I was reading it last night, and you know, it's actually one of those reports. I think you're right, Vicky. It's really interesting because it makes you think about a lot more than the kind of headline title on the front page. So look, Debbie, one of the things I was going to ask you was, interestingly, I think, you know, this idea of kind of distributed peer review, you know, is very much in there, right? You know, this is a good thing. This is the sort of thing that should, you know, crowdsourcing and so on and so on. But we've also had a report this week that critiques what happens when, for example, you know, in the kind of academic freedom and freedom of speech debate, what happens when, you know, you kind of leave things to the crowd, you know, Alice Sullivan's second report, you know, discussing academic freedom broadly is worried about what happens when you kind of leave things to the crowd, particularly in an environment where, for example, gender critical views might not be very popular. So where does crowdsourcing kind of fit in all of this?
And when does it lead to just, you know, booty McBoatface? I mean, what I think, but this is why we do meta science, right? So that we can kind of understand how these things work and put structures in place to deliver the goods and manage the risks. And I think, you know, the difference between, and I think, you know, and I think, obviously we're probably not going to get in deep into Alice Sullivan's critique of academic freedom, you know, the sort of the detail of it. But I think one of the kind of things that happens in that space is a sort of wild west unstructured piling on and the sort of proliferation of kind of small viewpoints turning into big viewpoints that then have the effect of you know, a chilling effect or tending towards a particular norm that some people then find themselves outside of. I think something like distributed peer review is about thinking about how can you sort of create that control process and then what weight do you give it then in the judgments that you're making. So, you know, I think it's fundamentally two quite different things, because
if you get it right,
the kind of the value of meta science is about sort of saying, how can we distill the wisdom of crowds without creating a sort of a crowd, you know, without that kind of reversion to the norm, you know.
Duncan, I guess, you know, one of the specific things I thought was kind of interesting is this thing about program managers rejecting more bids all on their own. You know, I mean, where does all of that fit with the kind of, you know, the Haldane principle from where you're sat?
Yeah, I mean, I was on the board of the Australian Research Council and had a lot to do with various attempts to try out new ways of assessing grants more speedily and in a more sort of transparent way at the same time. And they are hard things to reconcile. I mean, we know, and there's this other, and I found this fascinating report, there's this other deeper question that's out there now, which is, you know, has science stalled, right? Like, is there, and maybe it's posed at too high a level, but there's a feeling that given all the people who are doing science, given all the funding going into science, I just use science now in the German sense of all kinds of research, you know, has it stalled? And is it partly because we're rewarding grant writers, as said earlier, rather than actually new ideas? And given the role of the track record in most of our funding council sort of weightings and assessments, I think there's some merit to asking that question in a really hard, open way. Are we allowing enough novelty to break through the system? So on the one hand, we've got gargantuan bureaucracies now in place to manage our research sort of system. We've got more people than ever before applying for grants. And in part, that's because they're being motivated and driven to do so by what, you know, the universities are encouraging them to do. Yet, you know, are we getting the best outcome from that? How do we speed that up? How do we make it more transparent? You know, you can use expressions of interest that administrators then sort of quickly do a quick scan on and do a first call on and then hand on to reviewers. So I think it's really tricky. I do think the value of this report, though, and the value of metascience more generally, is to just get some new thinking injected into the research system that, you know, otherwise might not happen from the councils and funders themselves, or indeed from the universities themselves in a sort of funny way. But I really welcome it. I think we do need to ask some hard questions, because I know our research community is really unhappy with the state of the sort of research enterprise in terms of how we're funded and how those programs work.
On the train, because, you know, it's now the summer, so, you know, bolting around the country, talking to new student leaders. I'm not always, you know, working on the train, because sometimes you can't. So the other day I was watching the new Adam Curtis thing, and then an interview with Adam Curtis, this, you know, kind of documentary filmmaker, uses lots of archive clips and so on. And one of the arguments he was making in this interview was, the thing about AI is it kind of traps you in the past. And so I'm kind of interested in this idea that kind of citation metrics are out and it's AI that will find all the novelty, because surely what AI does is tell you all of the things that happened in the past, not the new things that, you know, we're discovering in the future.
Well, I guess there's a truth in that. But also what AI does is cut down on bureaucracy. It can filter applications far more quickly than a human being can. It can point out, you know, where there are ideas that are reliant on history and where there are outliers that might be new. So I guess that's a way of getting AI to move us away from the past. It's, you know, I think there is enormous scope for AI to do the bulky, time-consuming bureaucracy and allow humans to come in and make evaluations on the result of that. And that, I think, moves us away from the past.
Debbie, I guess, you know, one, the other thing that stuck out for me is, and I'm quite sad about this, partial randomization didn't work. Yeah, are we kind of obsessed with, kind of wedded to a kind of cult of excellence? You know, dare we ever leave anything to chance?
I think when it comes to research, you do sort of have to. I mean, I may just be being, you know, like, you know, disastrously kind of square and traditional in this view, but
you're so elitist.
I do think that particularly where the incentives are to kind of get as much research out the door as possible, and you know, that's kind of that is, I think, that Duncan, you know, said. Can stack up the incentives in a sort of funny way. You do need to be really, really confident that the things that are being given public funding are the things that are, like, you know, likely to advance the discipline, and, you know, and hence, you know, the general state of knowledge and the economy and public life and all the rest of it. So, you know, there is, and, you know, inevitably there's going to be more great research that could be done than there is funding to support it. I think reading this report, what my mind went back to Ottoline Laser, the outgoing UKRI chief executive, testimony to the science committee in the Commons a week before, where she's sort of saying, actually, I think, you know, the sort of the way we organise research in this country is probably going to have to change because of the sort of systematic, it's not underfunding per se, but, you know, you can't make the kind of full economic cost of any given research project. So there is going to need to be a bit of thinking about how to generate economies of scale and you know, so I think there might be something to do before it reaches the funder to really think about what are the research priorities, how do we think about, you know, what the direction of travel in these different disciplinary areas are, you know, looking at the industrial strategy and thinking about that. You know, but fundamentally you do need to still be able to say we're funding excellent research, right? I mean, that is how you do that, I think, should be up for debate, but it's got, you know, it's still got to be excellent. Yeah.
Duncan, I guess, you know, The final thing is the kind of undercurrent to some extent is, you know, one of the promises here is that what meta-science will do is generate leaner bureaucracy. And, you know, whenever someone is selling this to me, you know, in my personal life, I always wonder whether, you know, taking the dredge out of things is going to be something that I benefit from or whether my employer wonky.com benefits from. You know, if there are savings, will they flow back to universities or is, you know, is that going to help Rachel Reeves?
Yeah, no, history tells us that's not a likely prospect. But being a vice chancellor now, telling my own community, I want to make life less drudgery for you, I feel the challenge. Look, as I said, I don't think there's a lot of financial savings necessarily to be made when we think about the report's sort of summary or its outcomes. But I think there's a lot of benefit to thinking hard about how we sort of manage the research process and how we create a way to preserve the possibility for novelty to emerge in the way that really moves science and research along and also benefits the community and also gets the community excited about research and so they can see the value of it. So I don't think the best way to justify this kind of work is it's going to deliver a whole bunch of savings, which we can then plow back into research. I think it's about how it improves the quality and dynamism of the research system and gives our researchers a reason to keep going and keep hoping.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So huge thanks to Duncan, Vicky, Debbie, Michael Salmon for making it happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.